Mentioned last night I was going to do some talking here. I was asked to, and I felt that it is probably the thing to do. We've had some terrific speakers up to now, and they've had something really to offer. And a good many of you people have heard me talk many times, I suppose. Some of you never have. So I hope someone profits by it. I'm what you call a fundamentalist in AA. I stay by the rules in this fellowship. And let me say a few things about it before I get started. I want to talk about our program tonight. And last night I mentioned that when I came to this fellowship, it was not yet known as Alcoholics Anonymous. It was the Oxford movement. And we did not have the book, the AA book. We didn't have any of this literature. We didn't have these meeting halls. We didn't have these retreats. We didn't have any conventions. We didn't have anything like this. And everything we did in those days was pioneering. The Alcoholics Anonymous was born in the Oxford movement. The Oxford movement was a religious movement, and it was Protestant by complexion. And they had six steps. And there we got our program. We essentially followed what their program was, in essence. They had a admittance that there's something wrong with a person's life. He'd have to admit that. He had certain sins he wanted to overcome. And then it was a matter of a surrender. It's a matter of making restitution. It's a matter of carrying the message and living by guidance, living by the rules of the four absolutes, which are absolute honesty, unselfishness, purity, and love. That's a tough program. A good many of the groups up in Ohio still use the four absolutes. You'll find it on their literature, on the Ohio-approved literature. And it's a real ideal to try to follow. I've never found anyone who could do it perfectly, but we try. That's our program tells us that we're aiming toward perfection, you know. So that's it. The reason for Alcoholics Anonymous, some of you folks have never heard this story, but I want to be very brief about it. When the Oxford movement was a religious movement, and they had great faith, and they felt that through their program, anyone who needed any kind of help, spiritually, morally, or what have you, could obtain it by following out the tenets of the Oxford movement. And it was a good movement. It was worldwide. And they were getting along fine, so they got mixed up with these rummies. And this really nearly put them on the bum eventually. But what happened is this. They, in Akron and in New York, Bill Wilson came into the Oxford movement in New York. Ebbie Thatcher brought him into the Oxford movement. And they had a few fellows, Hank Parkhurst and a few more up there in New York. And as you read in the story, I suppose Bill came to Akron on a business venture, which failed. And he was pretty downcast, and he wanted to find a rummy to talk to, or he wanted to find someone in the Oxford movement to talk to, really, and a rummy if possible. So by a string of events which were most assuredly guided, he came into connection with Reverend Tunk in Akron, and Reverend Tunk knew about the Oxford group that Bill referred to, and he put Bill in touch with Henrietta Seiberling. And Henrietta Seiberling was very active in the Oxford movement, and she knew Doc Smith very well, and Doc was attending Oxford group meetings there for 2.5 years, but he was getting drunk all the time. It was not working. So when Bill got in touch with Henrietta, she arranged for the meeting with Doc and Annie, and you know the rest of the story. They got together. Doc only had one drunk after that. And this is the way the nucleus of our fellowship started. Well, Doc got busy. Being a medical doctor, he was on the staff of Akron City Hospital. This was long before they used St. Thomas. And he used to smuggle drunks into Akron City Hospital under different pretexts. In fact, he put me in Akron City Hospital, but not for alcoholism. I was in there for anything, but he had a disease for me, all right. But I suppose I had it, too. But it wasn't alcoholism. They wouldn't let a rummy in a hospital in those days. So that was it. So when I sobered up, I was in that hospital a week. And then he took me to Oxford Group Meeting. And I attended meetings there for 15 months in Akron, Oxford Group Meetings. And I had to go back and forth from Cleveland to Akron to attend my meetings. There was no such thing in Cleveland. I met the members, the alcoholic members of the Oxford Group in Akron while I was incarcerated in this hospital. There were about 18 of them. And they came and told me their stories about what had happened to them through booze. They were all much older men than I was, 10, 15, 20 years older than I was. That accounts for the reason that they're all dead and gone now. I was only 35 years old when I went into that hospital. After a while, after I was sober for some time, Doc had told me that I would have to spend the rest of my life fixing drunks as an avocation. We used to call it fixing in those days. And I went back to Cleveland and endeavored to fix every drunk I could find. And I really scoured every place, and there was no shortage of drunks and rummies and alcoholics and dipsomaniacs or what have you. I often said I became the first and foremost bar stool snatcher in history. But you see, it was all pioneering, it was all promotion. It jars me sometimes when I read some of this stuff that you read about AA, that this is a program of attraction rather than promotion. Kids, if I'd have waited for some drunk to be attracted to me, we'd all still be waiting to get in here. We had to promote, and we had to fight our way in everything. It was all pioneering. Well, something happened after 7 months of this. I finally got my first baby in the hospital. Believe me, I had arrived. I felt I really belonged now. And somehow or other, right after that, a whole slew of them started coming. So we had about a dozen of them going down to Akron from Cleveland. And odd thing happened. Here's the next step that God had for us. As it happened, out of those dozen fellows that were going down from Cleveland, seven of them were Catholics. And at that time, a Catholic was not permitted to belong to the Oxford movement. It wasn't the Oxford movement that kept them out. Their church kept them out because of some of the forms and ceremonies and different things that went on in the Oxford movement. I don't have time to explain them here. But just believe it. So something had to be done. These fellows couldn't belong. So I went down to talk to my sponsor about it, Doc Smith, and I told him our problem. He says, well, we're not keeping them out. I says, no, you're not keeping them out, but their church keeps them out, which is all the same thing. They can't come. He says, well, that's tough. I says, well, no, that don't have to be tough. I says, we can arrange something. He says, what are you talking about? I says, well, we have a book now. We'd written this book in the fall of 1938. It was published early 39. And this has all taken place in May of 1939. I'm 15 months old at this time. 15 months sober. I know everything, of course. I'm telling my sponsor what to do now. This is normal. Well, anyway, as it turned out, I think I happened to be right for once, because history has proven that. So I told Doc, I says, we don't need all this hullabaloo that the Oxford Group goes through, all these ceremonies and forms and one thing another. We have a 12-step program now in our big book, and all we need is that and the four absolutes, and anyone can live with that. He says, well, you can't do that. I says, why not? He says, you can't break this thing up like that. We owe our life to these people. I said, Doc, I owe my life to the Oxford Group people, too. But what about the rest of these people? He says, well, that's their funeral. I says, no, it ain't. We're going to do something about it. About that time, I had another Irishman in the hospital, Al Goldrick. He had a big home up in the Heights. I went out to see his wife and asked her about using their home for a meeting place. Never asked Al anything about it. He's all smoked up down there with formaldehyde in the hospital. He wouldn't know what he's talking about anyway. And Grace Goldrick was delighted to have us meet there. So when old Al came out of the hospital, he found out his house was a meeting house. Al was a patent lawyer. He was getting kicked out of his firm, and he's losing his house, but eventually he saved the whole thing. Well, anyway, I went down to Akron the next week and announced that this is the last time the Cleveland contingent will be down here as a group. We were going to have our own group in Cleveland, Ohio, and I made the mistake of telling them the address. And I says, we're going to have a meeting in Cleveland at 2345 Stillman Road, Cleveland Heights, next Thursday night. And only alcoholics and their families are welcome, nobody else. Wow. I says, this is not going to be known as an Oxford movement. It's going to be known as Alcoholics Anonymous. We're taking the name from the book. Boy, I tell you, the roof came off of T. Henry's house where we were meeting. Awful riot. I just say, AA started in a riot and it grows in riots. That's unity. Well, anyway, if I thought that was a riot, people all over me say, Clarence, you can't do this. I said, it's done. We must talk about it. There's nothing to talk about. It's all done. So it was really something. It was awful. I lost an awful lot of friends that night. Some people never spoke to me again, really. Well, anyway, if I thought that was bad, you should see next Thursday night in Cleveland. That whole bunch descended upon us in a body at our meeting and tried to break the meeting up. One guy was going to whip me. Now, I want you to know this is all done in pure Christian love. There's nothing more vital than Christian love. But we stood our ground, and that's how AA started. That was the first AA group in the world in Cleveland, Ohio, May of 1939. Now, we had the 12 steps to go by and the four absolutes. The 12-step program anyone can accept. People, so many people, get spirituality and religion confused. And I see people come into AA in the times past, and they still do. And they get some kind of religious fervor, and they're jumping around like a cat on a hot stove from one religion to another. And it's ridiculous. And it's too bad, and it's a sickness they have. And some of them better, by God, get well about that, because if they don't, they're going to get in awful lot of trouble. I saw this happen with the early days of AA. And I just throw that out as a warning, because I met some people right here who are having that problem right now. And you better not start putting religion ahead of spirituality. You can have any religion you want, but spirituality is what we're interested in here. We're not preaching religion of any kind. Now, the thing is this. We got this 12-step program, and I hear some very peculiar things about this program in getting around here and there and everywhere. And I want to give you my concept of what it is. I think that our program, since we have an illness here, our program is a prescription for getting well and staying well. That's important, staying well also. Now, people come to me and they talk about these steps, and I hear it, I still hear it, heard it here already. When are we supposed to take these steps? Well, my reply to that is, you're sick, aren't you? Yeah, I'm sick. Well, when do you want to get well? Christmas, 4th of July, Labor Day, Easter, Mother's Day? No, I want to get well now. Well, let's take the medicine now. And here's the medicine. Step one. Everything, we have 12 steps, and every one of them has a number on it. Did you ever notice that? They all have a number. And they're not numbered 1, 7, 5, 11. They're 1, 2, 3, right on down to 12. And there's a reason for that. I hear people say, I'm having such an awful time with step 5 or step 4 or what have you, and I'm going back and take step 4. If you're going back and taking some steps, there's only one reason for ever going back and taking any of those steps. And that reason is if you have resigned and resumed. Once you take them and you don't take them anymore. Period. You have to know about them if you want to explain them to someone or help them through them. But as far as taking them over and over and over, forget it. And I'm going to show you what a simple program we have. But I say no matter how simple it is, an alcoholic can screw it up. An alcoholic can screw up a 2-car funeral. And it's much simpler to screw up this program. And they do it. And they start analyzing instead of utilizing. Now here's a scoop. Step one. Our program is divided in four phases, or four distinct parts to our program. The first step is our first phase. That's the phase of admittance. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our life had become unmanageable. Did you hear that? It says alcohol. You know, I get a lot of people coming in AA today. They think this is a wonderful thing. Everybody should have it. Well, God bless them. I think everybody should have a program like this. But we're interested in alcoholics. The name on that book says Alcoholics Anonymous. It does not say Dopes Anonymous, Fatso Anonymous. It doesn't say Pool Shooters Anonymous, Gamblers Anonymous, or Fatso Anonymous, or Nose Pickers Anonymous. It's Alcoholics Anonymous, and we have our hands full taking care of alcoholics, and that's our mission. So it says, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our life had become unmanageable. There's two things it tells us there. We're powerless over alcohol, and our life is unmanageable. Two things. The next step, that's phase one. The second through the seventh step is a phase of submission. Here we have admission, now we have submission. Here's where we submit our will and our life to the care of God. So the second step says, we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. We came to believe it. It didn't say we believed it when we got here. I certainly didn't believe it. I came to believe it. Why did I come to believe it? I came to believe it by reason of the example of the men who preceded me, the alcoholics who preceded me. They told me the stories of their lives, what had happened to them through alcohol. They were all older men than I, but I could go right along with them. I did in 8 or 9 years what it took some of those fellows 30 years to accomplish. I was a hustler. So they told me that this had helped them, and there was a power that had helped them, and it would have helped me if I wanted it badly enough. And I sure did. So by their example, I wanted to be like them, so I was willing to believe anything they told me. So I came to believe this power could help me because of their example. That's why. Okay, now here's the third step. And here is a step that separates the men from the boys. Here's a step that determines whether you're going to be in AA or around AA. Unfortunately, there's an awful lot of people attending meetings and clubs and what have you that are around AA, but they're not in it. And you're not going to be in it till you've taken that third step. And this is the most important step you've ever taken in your life up to now. It says in that third step very plainly that we made a decision to turn our will and our life over to the care of God. Now, for a bunch of people with self-will run riot, that's something to do. And to make a decision to turn your will and your life over to the care of this ethereal creature in the far blue yonder, of whom you know very little bit about and been running away from for a long time, that's something to do. And I'll tell you further, if you don't hurt badly enough, you're not about to do that. Because that's where the first stumbling block comes for people, and they're going to start holding reservations there. When you skip that third step, kids, you skipped yourself around AA, and you're not in it. That's the one that makes the decision for us. We made a decision to turn our will and our life over to the care of God because we admitted in the first step that our life is unmanageable and we can't control it. We're helpless. We need a new manager. Our life is unmanageable. So here we are accepting and hiring a new manager. Someone else is going to manage our life for us. We've been doggone poor managers, or we wouldn't be looking for AA. So now we've hired a new manager in the third step. All right, if we're going to go into a life, into a new life under this new management, we better find out what we have to go into business with this new manager. Anyone going into business needs an inventory. You have to have some stock to work with, and what do we have to work with? So here's the fourth step. Listen to this one very carefully. It says in that fourth step that we made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Now, to be very complimentary to alcoholics, I don't think there's any alcoholic worthy of the name who has the capacity to take that step by himself. And the reason I say that is this. You and I are past masters in self-justification. And when it comes down to taking a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves, we're very apt to be very sweet on ourselves and overlook some things, the very things that we need to give attention to. I know when I was a drinking alcoholic and I get myself into a jam, it was never really my fault. It was always some series of events and circumstances caused by someone else, not me, because I was a pretty nice guy. And just because I happen to be locked up, I didn't cause this, or someone else caused it. I'd always find an alcoholic can find justification for anything. Anything. Think of the stories some of you boys told when you went home. And you gals, some of the stuff you pulled off. Self-justification. No, we had that little bit. The only way we could ever hold on to that little bit of pride we had was try to justify ourselves, and we were always on the defensive with it. I think that fourth step has to be taken with the help of a knowledgeable, experienced, loving sponsor, and probably a tough one. And sometimes the tougher a sponsor is, the more loving he is. You know, you can kiss these people right into the grave. Sometimes you've got to come down hard on people. And when it comes to the fourth step, this is where a person has to really face himself when he's been ducking this all this time. And he doesn't have the capacity to do that without help. So a sponsor standing at his elbow, giving him a nudge and a suggestion about this and sharing some things of his own life so that it'll make it easy for him to put this out on the table to him, this is going to make a complete job of it. The fifth step tells us or suggests that there is someone there. It says after this fourth step, it says in that fifth step very plainly, it says we admit it to God, to ourselves, and to another human being. What do we admit? The exact nature of our wrongs. Not the wrongs themselves. This is what a lot of people think they have to do, is sit down and tell every doggone distasteful thing and lousy stinking thing they ever did. That isn't what that fourth step says. That fourth step is talking about a searching and fearless moral inventory. What do we have morally working for us, and what do we have morally working against us that we have to get rid of? And what do we have to enhance in our life? That's what it means. And it takes a good, knowledgeable sponsor to help us with that. Now, we admit it to God, to ourselves, and another human being. You know, there's a biblical reason, and there's biblical authority for that fifth step. It says very plainly, when two or three are gathered together in my name, there will I be also. And we're going into business with our new manager. So we want to do this right. And we want him to be there so we have help there to bolster ourselves. Okay, that's the fifth step. After taking that fifth step, listen to this. It says we were entirely ready. Ready for what? Entirely ready, too. It didn't say just about getting ready or a little bit ready. It says we're entirely ready. An alcoholic is entirely in everything he does. No alcoholic ever does anything anyway but entirely. It's whole hog or nothing with an alcoholic. When he works hard. When he plays hard. And when he gets drunk, he makes a career out of it. This is the rummy. This is the alcoholic. This is you. This is me. The other people aren't like this. We're a breed all of our own. We're not like people. We're something else. We're something special. Don't you ever forget it. These people are so scared that somebody's going to know they belong to this AA. They're nuts. You're missing the boat. You should be very proud, because everybody can't be an alcoholic. Did you know that? This is a privilege reserved for a chosen few. And some people can drink and use booze for what it's intended. And never get in any, sometimes they get in a little trouble. A lot of them never get in any trouble. But you and I, booze is not for us. We're the people that cause the disaster to everything and everyone around us, including ourselves. So we're entirely ready, all the way. Ready, what? To have our new manager take over. To have God remove all these defects of character. Did you get that? All of them. Now, I know, if you're any way like I am, and I'm sure you are, there's some defects of character I'd rather keep. They're very interesting. Yeah, they're fun things. But you know, this program, when we're starting out in this program, it doesn't give us that leeway at all. This is all or nothing at all. You might as well make up your mind. This is the way it is, kids. So we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character, the fun ones and the whole bit. Jeez, we're going to get miserable now. The few little things we enjoy, we're going to give up, aren't we? Horse feathers. All right, the seventh step says this. Very simple step. It says we humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. We humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. It doesn't say we made a bargain with him. doesn't say like I used to say when I get in some kind of a jam. Oh, God, get me out of this mess, and I'll never drink again. I'll be a good boy. I'll never run out with Sadie Glutz again. I'll be good all the time. You can depend on it. Such a deal. You know, it never worked. Be right back in the same hole very shortly afterward. So we humbly asked him to remove all these shortcomings. Remove them. We're not going to remove them. We can't remove them. It's impossible for you and I to remove them. We said this back at the beginning. We were powerless over alcohol. Our life is unmanageable. We made a decision to turn our will and our life over to the care of our new manager. Now we're asking our manager to do something. Asking him humbly. It says in the good book, anything we ask, believing, we shall receive. He says, ask and you shall receive, you know. So we ask him humbly. And he'll do it. He'll do it. No doubt about that. He's the boss now. He's the boss. He's going to put it up to him. Don't mean that just because you have a boss that you don't have work to do. Your boss always has things for you to do. And this boss is going to have a lot of wonderful things for you to do. A lot of things you don't want to do, too. But you'll do them if you're going to work for this boss. All right, we've had our second phase. Phase of submission. We've submitted our will and our life to the care of God absolutely and entirely. You all get that? This is our program. Very simple program. Now we go into phase three. Phase three is restitution. We're going to go in under new management. We're going to have a new life. And we do not want to carry any of the old garbage from the old life in. And we owe some apologies to people. Now listen how simple this is. These are two steps that also should be taken with the help of a knowledgeable sponsor. Because there, again, in our newness here, in our new enthusiasm for this kind of living, we can go out, we're so anxious to get our skirts cleaned, we can hurt a lot of other people if we don't have some wisdom used here. And the alcoholic coming in at this stage of the game, this early in his career, don't have that kind of wisdom. He don't have it. He hasn't cultivated that yet, so he needs somebody to help him in the eighth and ninth steps. So the eighth step says, we made a list of all persons we had harmed. See? Made a list of them. Now listen to this. Here's what's important in this step. And became willing to make amends to them all. Became willing to make amends to them all. Well, you know, in my experience, there are several people that I didn't even want to see, let alone go out and make apologies to. And I feared that, and I shuddered, and I shook about it. But I had to go, and I did, and I'm glad I did. Those people are dead and gone now, but I had the chance. And I could tell you those two experiences, they still make me shudder when I think about them. But I did it, and I'm glad I'm free of it. I'm not carrying anything over into my new life from that life of garbage and despair that I had. So we made direct amends wherever possible. Get that? Except when to do so would injure them or others. You see, in our new enthusiasm, we can go out and really tear things up with people and cause a lot of trouble. You know, I want to give you a couple of examples, or at least one. I don't care what your problems have been. They can be taken care of in that eighth and ninth step. That thing of restitution. Let me tell you a story about one fellow, just as an example. We think that, well, the things are just impossible. I can't make things right with so-and-so, and if I do this and that, I'm going to get into this and that. No, you won't. I knew a fellow. Some of you people, if I mention him, know him too, because he lived in Tampa. This was some years ago. I met this boy over there, and he disappeared. I didn't see him for several years, and one day I'm walking down the street in Sarasota, and here I run right smack dam into this guy. He says, Clarence, he says, my God, of all people, you're the one guy I want to see. He said, I want to talk to you. I have to talk to you. Please. I said, okay, let's go talk. So we went over and sat down in a hotel lobby, and he told me his problems. And these were strictly problems of restitution. Well, I'll tell you a few things about the things that he had to be cleared up in his restitution. First of all, this boy had been married 5 times. No wife had ever died. He had no divorces. Yeah? Right? I knew his last wife. She got... All the other four had kids by him. This last one didn't have any kids. She got out lucky. He had been working in construction work down in South Florida. And in, maybe some of you folks might be aware of it, but a lot of that development down there some years ago was financed with mafia money. And he got his fingers into some of their dough and disappeared with it. And they were looking for him. And this is uncomfortable. Well, I just mentioned a few of these things, and he can't get jobs. He's afraid to get jobs because he'll be traced, and he has to pick up money, and he's stealing and doing everything else. Eventually, he's going to wind up in the can anyway because he's been breaking into places at night. He told me all these stories, the things that happened to him, a lot more. But I just give you those as a starter. Well, do you know, it took some doing that he couldn't do himself, and no one person could do for him either. It had to take an awful lot of guidance and direction. But that fellow never has spent a day in jail, and he didn't get a concrete overcoat. He's still among the living, and he's healthy, and he's able to do things now. Now, if he can get by with all that, as far as restitution's concerned, think about some of your problems in restitution. I just give you that as an example. It has to be done. This man would have wound up in a padded cell if he'd come. He's half crazy when I met him, really. With fear and guilt and everything else. Well, okay. There's your restitution. It's the third phase of the program. We made direct amends wherever possible, except when to do so it is your then rest. It takes someone to help a fella or a girl that's in that position. Now, in restitution, there's something else. Some of these things may be bugging you. You've done something in your life that is on your conscience and on your heart, and you can't get rid of it. I had a girl several years ago. Grace knows this girl. She had a secret on her heart that she had never, her husband didn't know about. And this was bothering this girl. She bothered her to the point that she had epilepsy. And she was scared to death, this girl was. And she had no more idea about a spiritual way of life than a hog knows about Sunday, really. She's one of the few people I ever met in my life that really never had any real spiritual or religious training. Really, none. Very seldom do you find a person in a civilization that's in that shape. But she absolutely was a blank in that department. And her husband was very worried about her. The girl don't live around here. She's way out in the west. We were out there, and her husband wanted me to talk to her. So Grace and her husband took off and went fishing or something. And I spent the greater part of the day with this girl. And she unloaded her whole story to me. Got it out on the table. Got rid of it. The thing that was worrying her and concern and had her that she could never become normal in any decision she was making. Isn't that right? Today, you got to see this girl. This works. This is the way it has to be done. We have to help people in this way. You and I have to train ourselves so we can be of help to people. It's our job. No one else can do this. These are things she wouldn't tell anybody. But somehow or other, the good Lord prompted her into doing it when I was there, and her life has changed entirely. You'd have to meet this girl to appreciate what a change there is in her. Terrific girl now, okay? She don't even have epilepsy anymore. How about that? Doesn't have any seizures anymore. Hasn't had them for several years. Okay? She don't take any medication for them either. The good Lord healed her. Right. So there's the third phase of our program. See how important this program is in our scheme of life? It is life. It's life to us. If you want to live, we have the prescription for living. All right, now we have taken 9 steps. Listen carefully to this, because first time I ever said this over there, in your neighborhood over there, that hasn't subsided yet. They're still squawking and yelling and screaming, some of them. Clarence is rewriting the book. Clarence is rewriting the program. He says we don't need the steps anymore. I didn't say that at all. Here's what I said, and I say it again and again. after you have taken these 9 steps, forget them. Forget them. You don't have to mess around with those 9 steps anymore. Don't come around and tell me what a hard time you're having with a step 3 or step 5 or step 6 or what. Horse feathers. You've never taken any of them or you wouldn't be talking that silly. Now, that's true. That's talking right up from the shoulder. After you have taken 9 steps, forget them. You don't need them anymore. The only time you'll ever use those 9 steps is in 2 instances. God bless you that you never should have to use them in the first. If you ever resign and resume, you're going to have to do them all over again. So you start new. But the only other time you have to refer to those 9 steps is when you're trying to explain them to someone, such as I'm doing now, then you have to know what they're all about. Okay? So we've taken 9 steps, and we're free. After step 3, you no longer have a drinking problem. How do you like them apples? People talk about a drinking problem. You don't have a drinking problem after you've turned your will and your life over to the new manager. That's his problem. And he'll tell you what to do with your other problems. But he'll take care of the drinking problem because he's going to guide your life from now on. And I'm sure he's not going to guide you into a bar room to get drunk or anyplace else or in your closet either. He has more important things for you to do. You see, God don't do all these things. God works through you and me. He works through people. And he needs you and me to do his work. You know, I'm a great believer in this. So here we've done these 9 steps. Forget them. Now just see how simple this program is if you have the guts to go through the first 9 steps. You heard that? Guts? Guts. Get a good sponsor and he'll help you with the gut department. All right. Now we only have 3 steps to be concerned about. How about this? It's no longer a 12-step program. It's a 3-step program. The last 3 steps are the steps of construction. Here's where we construct our life. We live our life and we enlarge our life in the last 3 steps. Listen to these steps. After you have taken the 9, here's the scoop. Step 10 is an inventory step. But it has absolutely nothing to do with step 4. People are always getting that screwed up. In the step 4, it says we made a searching and fearless moral inventory. It don't say one blooming thing about that in step 10. Step 10 says something entirely different. It says in step 10, we continue to take a personal inventory. And it says something else. And when we were wrong, we promptly admitted it. What does that mean? Personal inventory. This is a day-by-day check on ourselves, our daily activities. That's our personal inventory. It's what did I do today? Who did I meet? What transpired? Did I do any good? Or did I do any harm? Do I owe any apologies? Do I get any gold stars today? It's a check on our daily activity. We talk about a day at a time. A lot of people, alcoholics, screw that up even. They think this means staying sober a day at a time. It don't mean staying sober a day at a time at all. It means living a day at a time. This is a living program. The longer you worry about staying sober a day at a time, and staying sober or staying drunk or what have you, the more apt you are to get drunk because you just keep drink conscious. The best thing that an alcoholic could do is get drunkenness and sobriety out of his mind and devote himself to living, the rules of living. That's what we're here for, to learn how to live and live like human beings are intended to. And you and I, of all people, have the greatest opportunity to do that because we have come to a point in life that a lot of people probably never will, or if they do, they don't recognize it. We have come to an extremity. There used to be a saying in the old Oxford movement that man's extremity is God's opportunity. I often refer to old Kierkegaard when he said, whom God would use, first he reduces to nothingness. He reduces to nothingness. Believe me, kids, if there was ever a nothingness, I was it. And I know he has used me. And he couldn't have used me if I hadn't been reduced to nothingness. And he couldn't be using you either. Because you still would be in there rocking the boat yourself. When we finally give up completely and turn our will and life over to that new manager, he'll give us the directions to go. All right. The 10th step is a check on our everyday life. This is where We meet with one another socially, in business, at home, at AA, or wherever. I'm a salesman, and I meet a lot of very kooky people. I get mad at them because they won't buy my stuff. And they waste my time. And I spend money getting my time wasted. And believe me, I think, as I've often said, we have all kinds of days that we celebrate. We celebrate St. Patrick's Day, Easter Day, Mother's Day, New Year's Day, Christmas Day, lots of days. Columbus Day, Labor Day. I often say there ought to be a day for salesmen where they can shoot people with impunity. But that's the way it is. No. So I only mention that for this reason. How kind can we still be? How loving can we be in the face of some of the despicable circumstances we come up against sometimes? This is a test of our tolerance sometimes. This is very important, how we handle everyday things, little things. It isn't important how we handle big things in this life, because in the first place, there's not enough big things ever happened to us to make it worthwhile. You think big things are important to you? Alcoholics, they get some idea. They always want to do something big. They want to wash an elephant. You know, nothing little. They can't wash a puppy. It has to be an elephant. See? Well, figure it out. They're always talking about big things. How many big things ever happen in your life anyway? Did you ever stop to figure this out? Just figure it out. Born. That's a big event which you had nothing to do with but arrive. And everybody passing out cigars about it. Well, maybe you got a good education. That would be a big thing, I think. Maybe you're successful in your job or in business and get advancements and you're very prosperous. I think that'd be a big event. Every time you get married, it's a big event. See? Right? You have a family, that's always important. You inherit $1 million. That's a big event. How many people here have inherited $1 million? The room is full of them. See? You win a fortune on a raffle or something, or on a sweepstake. That'd be a big event. Inherited $1 million. The room is full of them. See? You win a fortune on a raffle or something, or on a sweepstake. That'd be a big event. You die. That's the last one. They bury you, 2 weeks later, people forgot all about you. Those are big events. They mean nothing. The events that mean something is our everyday little things, association of one with another, how we deal with other God's children. This is what's important. Not only in AA, out of AA. Be kind. Indulge in other people. Help them. Go out of our way. Sacrifice our time and our talents and our substance to help other people who need our help. This is important. Not only chasing drunks, it isn't a matter of just sitting up all night with a drunk. It's a great privilege for you and I to come have a drunk or an alcoholic come to us that wants to have help, and we're able to help him. And it's a great thing for us to learn how to do it. We have to learn how to do this. This doesn't come just because we happen to come and attend the meeting. And we have to advance and learn and educate ourselves in these other departments, too, if we want to be efficient. There's all kinds of ways of reaching people. Some people you have to kiss them into AA. Some people you have to kick them into AA. Some people you have to come down awful hard on them for their own good. Really. There's all kinds of ways, but only experience and guidance from the Lord can tell you how to do it. But you'll get that guidance if you're living according to the program. How do you think a dummy like me, 15 months sober, without any appreciable education at all, no money, no nothing, no wardrobe, no anything, behind scratch in every way, could come up and argue with my sponsor, who was a co-founder of AA, and make a break with him and break completely away from him and start AA groups and break away from that Oxford group? You think that is because I'm smart? I was a lunatic. And I couldn't find my way out of a telephone booth for the first 6 months I was in AA. No, I didn't do this. I was directed to do this and guided to do it. Remember that. And you're going to be guided to do a lot of things that you would feel are impossible. I've seen so many things impossible happen. The impossible always happens. It comes about to the best ends. So we get down to this step down here, this 11th step. Now we go into this 10th step. It's an inventory step of our daily activities. Continue to take personal inventory. And when we were wrong, we promptly admitted it. When did a rummy ever admit he was wrong? A rummy won't admit it's raining outside. It might involve him in something. I mean, that's the first rule and law in a rummy's life. Don't admit anything. Don't give your right name even. Nothing. We become the greatest bunch of liars and four-flushers and everything in the world. Yes, sir. That tenth step is a powerful step. That's our check on our daily life. Now, how do I do mine? I keep it very simple. I can't stand a complicated program because I don't have sense enough to work a complicated program. I've been recently in some of these programs where they have 30-day programs where they take an alcoholics in and they give them counseling, they give them touch treatments, and this, that, all kinds of stuff they're giving them. Give them different knowledgeable books to read, and then once in a while they throw a little AA at them. And for 30 days, they go in there and spend $3,500 doing this. And they aren't out 3 days till they're ready to go back again. Why? I have no quarrel with psychiatry or psychology or any of that sort of thing. But I'll tell you one thing, sure. They're barking up the wrong tree when they try to mix the two of them, AA and psychiatry. You'll go one way or the other. You can't have them both. No, sir. And I have seen very few alcoholics who will ever stay to the discipline of a psychiatric program anyway. We won't do it. We're just inherently dishonest. And they'll never get us to come clean on it and do it. You see, what people don't realize, most people don't realize, that this is a program not of determination. This is a program of resignation. We have to resign ourselves to the fact that we're beat and we can't help ourselves and we need a new manager and we throw ourselves on his mercy and let him run the show. And we will do what he tells us to do without any argument. That's when we're going to succeed. When we start arguing and holding reservations, then's when we get in trouble. We're getting back in that driver's seat again and we're shunning our new boss off for quitting our job or we're firing him. People have a hard time believing this, that you'll get guidance for everything. Well, you better believe it. And I can tell you from experience, it's very true. All right. How do we get all this direction from our new boss? Well, let's find out. Let's get into the 11th step. This will tell us how we do it. Here is a real hummer, this 11th step. Listen carefully. There's a lot of words in it. Because it says we're seeking something. We sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God, our new manager. We want a conscious contact with him. Now it tells us what we're praying for. Praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. Let's break that down. We're seeking something through prayer and meditation. We heard something this morning here about prayer and meditation. What is prayer and what is meditation, if you please? To me, prayer is talking to the new manager. That's talking to him. Meditation is listening to him. We are not supposed to do all the talking. We'll do some talking, then we should listen for the answers and the direction. The good Lord gave us two ears and one mouth. What do you think that suggests to you? Don't you think we ought to do a little listening? About twice as much as we do talking? He'll give us the direction. He'll answer everything we ask him. Sometimes the answer is no. Sometimes, well, maybe later. And sometimes the answer is yes. Sometimes the answer is go here, go there. Any of you folks that have been around AA any length of time, hasn't this happened to you? It's happened to me so many times. I've made plans of my own in my own little way. For a day, I've got to do this and that at such and such a time, at such and such a time, I'm going to be here and there. But when it comes time to be here and there, I am somewhere else, doing something I had no idea of ever doing when I got up this morning in making my own plans. But my boss had plans for me, and he sent me someplace else, and there I am. I have never gone out on a 12-step call in my experience that I can remember of before consulting my new boss, asking him to help me, and direct me, and show me the way with this bird. And I could stand here and tell you some experiences I've had with people that you would find hard to believe, because that's hard for me to believe it myself. The only reason I believe it is I know it happened. Because I did things way, way, way beyond my capacity. I accomplished things way beyond my capacity in any way you look at it. And they come back with wonderful results. That wasn't me. I said a little while ago, our new boss works through me. He don't do all this work. We do the legwork. He'll give us the orders. He's the boss. You're working for somebody. Your boss tells you to go down and make a deposit in the bank. You go. Tells you to run out and get him a sandwich. You go. You go and file a paper. Bring papers out of a file. You go do it. You go do anything he tells you. He pays you for that. What do you think this new boss pays you for all doing all these things? You get payment that you can't get in any other kind of cash. Believe me. So here we are. We sought through prayer and meditation, through talking to the boss and listening to the boss. What are we seeking? Seeking to establish conscious contact with him. Well, now, what does that mean? In all the years I was running wild here, God was something way out and beyond the blue out here. Way out, millions of miles away. I have to believe now that he's right here. He's my boss. I can converse with him and get orders from him. He has to be as close to me as Frank sitting here is, even closer. The good book tells me that he is closer than hands and feet. If you can find any closer than that, I want to know what it is. That's how close he is. If you'll believe this, and you better believe it if you want to have a good life. That's the teachings of our program. So we're seeking through prayer and talking to him and listening to him to improve our conscious contact. And I want to know that he's right here. And he is. He's accessible all the time. The good book tells us no matter where we go, in the deepest of hell, he'll be there with us. You can't run away from him. He's there. He's always there. We try to run away, but he's there. He's there just the same. We turn our back, but he's there. We better turn around and face him and accept him. That's the name of the game in this program. So we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with our new boss. Now it tells us what we're praying for. It says we're praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry it out. Boss, what do you want me to do? I am your boy. Send me and give me the power to do it. He made the promise that he'd never put anything on us that he wouldn't give us the power to execute. So there it is. There's the step, the 11th step. Terrific. It's the second step in our last phase of the program. Those are the second of our living steps. 12th step. Here's the 12th one. Here's the most maligned one of the bunch. You hear so much about 12-stepping. Just what is 12-stepping? It says here, listen to what this 12-step actually says. Might give you a different slant on 12-stepping. It says in there, we've gone through these 11 steps, it says, having had a spiritual experience as a result of these steps. How do you like that? Because of these steps, as a result of going through them, something happened to us. What happened? We had a spiritual experience. And what is that? That's that change in here. Not in here. People always come in here talking about change in their thinking. What thinking? If you could think, you wouldn't come in here in the first place. We're not a gathering of thinkers here. We're a gathering of anything but. We do things, but we don't think. The big difference, you know, one of the wildest things that ever happened in AA was when this guy brought that think sign around that they hang up in clubs. I'll never forget it. I know this poor old boy dead now, but he was a good friend of mine. He got a whole bale of these things from the IBM company, and they used to hand them around to offices to influence the office, help to do better work in the office, and he speaks sign think. And he got a whole big box of these things, a whole crate of them, and he thought he got thinking, which is a big mistake for any alcoholic. He got thinking he ought to send one of these to every AA group in the world, and they should hang it up in their club room or in their meeting hall, and that it would inspire these rummies out there think. So people accept that. They buy them now. They even pay for them. This is the kind of thinking they got. When an alcoholic is thinking, he gets in trouble. An alcoholic who should not think. That's what we got Al-Anons for. The big difference between alcoholics and earth people, civilians, is this. Civilians think and alcoholics feel. Now, if we got a sign going around there, feel, and put it up, it'd be more fun. It's a lot more appropriate, too. We don't think. You know how long it takes an alcoholic to get to think? Let me tell you how long it takes. There are stages of growth in an alcoholic's career when he comes to AA. I say this, the first 3 months is a critical period in his life. Everybody's been kicking him around. He's running from everybody's hiding, and nobody likes him. Everybody hates the bugger. He's in trouble with everyone. And he comes in here, and all of a sudden he gets a lot of friends, and people are glad to see him, and they make a big fuss over him. They kiss him and all this kind of business. And it's wonderful. He's got friends, and he just, it's a different world. 3 months, he's walking his high. Well, if he lives through this 3 month period, another period comes about 9 months in his experience. By 9 months, he's a veteran already. He is telling the new people how to clean up the ashtrays and move the chairs around and all this kind of thing. He is gets to be a patriarch all of a sudden. He's an old-timer because he's looking down at some of these new ones that are just struggling in, and he's giving them their orders. 9 months. Well, if he gets through that area without any hazard or collapse, there comes another period of a year. The one-year thing, it has a time limitation. This is especially dismal for a periodic alcoholic. Because this periodic has signed pledges, he's sworn off, he's been threatened with a year and all this kind of business, and he's never made the year. He's got up to 360 days a few times, but he never quite cracked this year yet. So, you know, there's two kinds of alcoholics. Let me say this. There's two. There's the periodic. That's the guy that has trouble at the year. He has some qualms. Because he gets to a year, he's never made that, and he thinks, oh, I've got it made now. I've done it. So he's apt to lean back on his oars, and if he does, he'll fall out of the boat. The other fellow, the chronic, don't have that problem like this other fellow. There's a difference between these two birds. The periodic alcoholic, he's the guy that he causes us all the trouble. He ought to be barred from the world. He's the guy that causes all the disaster in the world. You know, he goes out, he's quite a guy. He only drinks on occasion, see? He's the guy, he'll build up a nice life for himself, get a good job, good income, nice family, nice home, couple of nice cars, belong to a couple of clubs, dresses well, moves around in good circles. And all of a sudden, for no apparent reason, boom, this guy gets drunk and everything goes. The whole works go. The house goes, the cars go, the wife goes, the family goes, the bank account, the whole bunch goes down the drain. It's gone. What does this bird do? This is what kills me. He gets another job, usually a better one than he had before. And he starts all over again and builds up this whole thing, gets a new wife, new family, new house, new cars, new bank account, a new thing. And everything's going along fine, and boom, the whole thing falls in ashes again. This is the story of his life. Now, those guys, they're the guys that give us a bad name. See? Now, I'm a chronic. I'm a steady Eddie. They can depend on me. I don't do those things. I stay drunk all the time. So people know what to expect from me. See? Well, anyway, in this thing of alcoholism, those two kinds of people we're dealing with here. That fella that's a chronic, he's slicker than the other fella because he tries to keep out of trouble. He hides when trouble starts, gets under the table, beats it, leaves. But no, not that periodic. He's in there swinging. He's going to really take part in everything. All right. That's the two kind of people we have. Now, we get to that 12th step having had a spiritual experience. As a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to other alcoholics and practice these principles in all of our affairs. Having had a spiritual experience as a result of these steps, there's a story. That's what we're looking for here. That's what we're starting out looking for, is that change. And it's not a change in our thinking. It's a change in our inner self here. Change, we're a different person. Now, we're a changed person. If you want a good life, we have it here. This is where we get it. It's right here. Most people never have this opportunity. Do you know that alcoholism is probably the oldest malady that afflicts the human race? If you don't believe that, you'll find stories of alcoholics in ancient history. You find it in mythology. You find them in the Bible. There's a lot of good rummy stories in the Bible. Sometimes I tell these stories at a meeting. And they're real stories of real rummies. Lots of them in the Bible. So this isn't anything new. But do you know this? Do you realize this? That only about 40 years ago was finally a plan devised that gave the alcoholic a chance for recovery. Up to this time, there had never been any chance for the alcoholic. He had two options. An alcoholic could go crazy or die or both. Since about 40 years ago, we now have another option. The alcoholic can go crazy, he can die, or he can get well. See, he didn't have that option before. I think, and I'm sure convinced of this, I like to think this, that the good Lord looked down on these rummies down over the centuries and saw all this carnage, this misery, and that I have to do something for these birds. And that's how AA started. And you and I are the people who have the opportunity to take part in this wonderful thing that has happened. You and I are the most fortunate people of all of God's people. They used to say the Jews are the chosen people. I don't believe that. I think we are. Unless a Jew is an AA, then he's twice chosen. But we are the chosen people. We are chosen for something that no one else can do. No one can do this but you and I. Don't you think it's about time that we all make ourselves efficient in this way of living? Now, there are ways to do this. I've told you about the 12 steps and how we prepare with these 9 steps for our living steps. And we live these steps. After we get into these last steps, there are ways that can help us to develop mentally, morally, and spiritually. And that's the name of the game. That's why we have retreats, is to point people and try to help them and inspire them toward living a better life, mentally, morally, and spiritually. This isn't a matter of just being sober. Don't ever get up in the morning and pray for sobriety. You have sobriety. Thank Him for it. He has given you this. It's a gift. Everything we have is a gift from our new boss. It's a gift of God. It's by grace that we are here. We better pay attention to these things and learn how to live under this kind of a domination. You and I have important things to do. I think back, when I look over this crowd tonight, and I think of the many, many people we've had in this room in these past 10 years, and I think of some of the people who have come here, they were completely desolate as far as any spiritual activity was concerned. Desolate, nothing. They knew nothing. They were confused. They were lost. They were scared. They were skeptical. They were around AA. They came here, some of these people, and they got into AA. They're no longer skeptical. They don't have to search and wonder and worry and have fears. They live comfortable lives. I think of some of them that have come here who've passed on to their reward. And what a wonderful thing it is to think and to know that those people, through the help they received in Alcoholics Anonymous and in this retreat and such similar things to this, it has changed their whole, the direction of their soul. That's something to think about. I never want to forget that. You know, when we go out to sponsor some person, we ought to go out there equipped and know what we're getting into and know that our boss and our new manager is going to help us and depend on his help. You and I are the only ones that go out there, and we're going to have a responsibility when we go out there to meet somebody. Think on this. Just consider this. When you take on a new person, your responsibility is this. First, you're going to be responsible perhaps for this fellow's health. Perhaps you're going to be responsible for his life. I've seen this happen too. You're going to be responsible, yes, even for what happens to his soul. Something to think about. Something to consider. Something to feel. I believe when we get that into our little noggins and in our consciousness and believe that, as I do, when you go out to call on some person, you're going out there prepared. You're going to take your manager with you. You're going to ask him to do the job through you. And that's how the job's going to get done. I've seen this happen here in the last year or two in our own home. Grace will find some of these girls around who have been around AA, around it. And they're not getting what they know. There's something here, but they haven't got it. It's never come to them yet, or they haven't had the opportunity, or hasn't been presented in a way they can accept it. They want some help. They want something. They take a look at Grace. They want something that she has. You don't have to look at her twice to know she has something that a lot of people don't have. If you don't believe it, go take a look at her. I live with that gal. Okay? You can tell these people when you look at them. You don't have to listen to them. Look at them. They look different than other people. There's some glow about people. Okay. I've seen people, those girls come to the house. Grace will talk to them. She'll turn them over to me. I'll take them through their first three steps. Then she takes on from there. I have never seen one girl go astray that she's worked with under that basis. And I don't care if it's here or if it's in California or where it is. The same thing works because she's worked at every place she's gone. Now, I'm bragging on her a little bit. She does this. Why? It's her mission. That's what she's here for. She had to learn these things. When I first met her, she didn't know beans from a... Well, you know what I mean. About AA. She was dry. She wasn't sober. She was dry. She didn't understand this program. But she has dug into it, and she understands it now, and she's learning more every day. She has become efficient in the Lord's work. And if any of you birds, men or women, want anything she has, she'll be glad to share it with you. As I will, too. And there are other people sitting in here who can do the same thing. You better, by golly, believe this, because this is the time to do it. We're not preaching religion. We're not preaching AA. We're talking AA. People get so far away from AA and what it is. They read a lot of this stuff, and they depend on some person way out here in the yonder to do all these things for them, to send so much money, and it'll be done. That isn't the way it works. It's right here is where it is. You have your responsibility. I have mine. Each one of us has. And our main responsibility is to get our own life changed so we're equipped to help deliver the message where other people can get their lives changed. The Oxford Group called it a life-changing program, and this is a life-changing program. I've given you the exposition of the 12 steps, and one more thing I want to say about them. They're a prescription for living. Prescription. I like to make this analogy about the 12 steps and a prescription. Suppose you're sick. You get sick someday. We all do. And you don't know what's wrong with you. You just feel miserable. So you go to the doctor. He says, well, I'm going to have to put you in a hospital and run a lot of tests and examinations on you. It looks bad to me right now, so I'm going to have to take you in a hospital. So he puts you in a hospital. And nowadays, you don't get one doctor anymore. You get five because you got a union. One of them takes your blood, one takes your urine, one takes something else, and so on, and your heart and your liver and the whole kabang. They run all kinds of tests on you, run things through you and over you and on you and what have you. After you're in there a few days, your doctor walks in and you're waiting to get the results of all this testing business. And you're anxious. And he comes in, his face is hanging down about here. He looks at you, you know right now it's bad news. You say, "Doc, well, what is it?" He says, "I'm sorry." What are you sorry about, Doc? What's the matter? He says, "You have a terminal illness." You know, alcoholism is a terminal illness, too. If you don't believe this, I can prove that to you, too. So he tells you you have a terminal illness. You say, "Terminal, Doc? Doc, you, terminal, that means the end, don't it? Isn't the terminal the end of something?" "Yeah." "You mean I'm going to die?" "Uh-huh. Yeah." "Oh, Doc, I don't want to die. I'm too young. What's the world going to do without me? What's my family going to do? I don't want to die. I'm not ready to die. Is there no chance for me, Doc? Can't you do something? Please, Doc." "Well, yeah, I can do something." He says, "I can give you a prescription which will lengthen your life. You don't have to die right now." "Oh, boy, you feel relieved. You don't have to die right now. Terminal's further down the block." So he said, "Give me that prescription, Doc." So he writes out a prescription for you in that hand scratching that's peculiar to doctors. And he hands it to you and he says, "Take this over to the drugstore and get it filled and take it the way I did it." "Oh, are you relieved?" So you run down to the drugstore with his prescription. It's the first errand you make. "Say, Mr. Eckert, I've got a terminal illness, and the doctor gave me a prescription. He says it'll lengthen my life. Will you fill it for me, please?" "I'll be glad to." You give it to me. "Wait a minute, Doc, wait." Meantime, after the doc has left, you read this prescription. Well, you look at that, and it has 12 ingredients in it. Up here, there's an ingredient that you read down here, and that's sour stuff. You don't like sour stuff, so you make a mental note of that in that blubber up here. You go down a little further, and you find another thing down there. You see that down there, and boy, every time you take that stuff, it gives you gas, and you burp all the time. You don't like to burp in public. So you make a mental note of that one. And you go down a little further, there's another ingredient down there that it makes you itch, you scratch. You're allergic to it. You don't like that either. So you say, "Wait a minute, Doc. This thing here, it's that sour stuff. I don't like that. Will you just leave that out, please? This other thing down here, it makes me burp, that gaseous stuff. Will you leave that out, too? Yeah? Okay. And this other thing here gives me the itch. I don't like to scratch in public. How about leaving that out, too, huh?" Doc looks at you and says, "Are you sure that's what you want?" "Yeah." "Okay." So he fills it according to your orders. How well do you think you're going to get? This is exactly the same thing that people do with our 12-step program. There's steps in there they don't like. So some ninny stands up here in this podium and says, "Take what you like and throw the rest out the window." That's the kind of crap they fed Grace when she first came into AA. "Take what you like and throw the rest out the window. You might as well go out the window with it for all the good it's going to do you." That's our prescription for living. 12 steps. Take 9 of them. Then you can throw those 9 out the window and live on those 3. How about that? Isn't that some prescription? But you got to do those 9 first. It's been nice talking to you. I cut into Frank's time a little bit, but who cares? He isn't going to be bashful about it. He'll be here for a couple hours. So I want you to listen to Frank very carefully. He has a message. Every one of you should listen and take notes, if possible, to what Frank has to say. I've known Frank a good many years, and he has something to say, and believe me, he knows how to say it. Thank you all.